The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Connect with ultra-fast speeds and our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home.
Hello there, welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, conductor and choir master David Brophy told me about the great music the orchestra have in store for the RTE Concert Orchestra Winter Sessions, and how his passion for music made him a target for the school bullies as a child. Dawn French talked to me about the return of the Vicar of Dibley, bringing Beatrix Potter to the screen, and the release of her new novel, Because of You. And husband and wife duo Arthur and Deborah Carr told me about Cladderwatch, and their incredible efforts to prevent deaths by accident and suicide on the waterways of Galway City. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy it. Oh, lordy, lordy. Okay, the RTE Concert Orchestra. The winter sessions coming up this month include a John Lennon tribute for his 40th anniversary, hits from the musicals. Oh, we need all this. A Christmas special with an Irish flavour and a Viennese New Year's Day celebration with the ever-brilliant, world-renowned concert orchestra conductor and choir master, Mr. David Brophy. Welcome, David. Nice to see you.
Hi, Ryan. How's it going?
Thanks for coming into us today. Are you working away in Studio One in the next little while, or what's the plan?
Not today. Studying today for rehearsals with the National Symphony Orchestra on Wednesday. So.
I see. How's the rehearsal going vis-a-vis COVID? Is it weird or just recalibration?
It's utterly bonkers.
Is it?
Like everything else that's going on in the world. Yeah. And so normally, like, there's things like we got to do. Obviously, the social distancing is a big issue, because if you see an orchestra, normally they're all sitting on top of each other. And you've got string players who are used to having two players for what we call a stand or a desk, you know. Now they've all got to sit up with their own music stand. So we've had things where the first violins are coming to the end of a page, and normally you'd have the inside player, which is the person sitting furthest away from the audience, turns the page while the outside player keeps playing.
Yeah.
So you don't get a big hole in the thing, you know.
Yeah.
Now we've had situations in rehearsal where everyone turns the page at the same time. There's a big schmozzle. Everyone cracks up laughing and there's no sound. So we have to go to the library and go to Mary Adams' library and say, Mary, will you photocopy this page? Because we can't do the page turns. So there's all that going on. Obviously, the wind and brass, they can't wear masks. With the strings wear masks because they can't play into their oboes and their brass instruments with masks on. So they're in kind of perspex cages.
Just like, you know, a movie. It's a science fiction movie.
It is. And the other thing is that, like, because everyone's so spread out now, it's people are miles away from each other, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, like, you might have players who are like 30 metres away. Like, sound travels at 343 metres per second. So if you're 30 metres away, it's a tenth of a second, which is not that much, you might think. But actually, when you're playing fast music, it's like a semi-quaver. So it actually is a huge thing, you know. And everyone, so everything kind of, yeah, it's not easy. But to be frank, I should qualify all this. We feel so, like, seriously privileged to be able to play. Because I know musicians who have not performed or played at all since March. And we feel extremely lucky to be able to do live streaming.
We had the house band back on Friday night on the late, late. I'm a big fan of having live music on the show.
And
I hadn't seen them for ages. I forgot how much fun they were, what they brought to the programme, the energy in the studio, just the musicianship of it all.
Yeah.
And like you with the orchestra, you know, everything taken for granted, music, instruments, talent, beauty.
Yeah.
You know, it's so nice to have the band. This is your band.
And it's also the thing about, because when initially lockdown started, you know, we're all listening to music through our headphones and computers and online, everything, you know.
Yeah.
It's the notion of hearing music live in a room.
Yes.
The air around you is moving, vibrating to these amazing sounds with people who are holding violins and blowing into bits of tube and all that type of thing, making these amazing sounds, you know. And it's like, it's when it's taken away from you is when you obviously you appreciate that bit more, you know.
And will the sessions we're talking about are to be downloaded streamed, is that it?
So we've recorded over the past few weeks some sessions in the concert orchestra. We were in the RDS And so we've got the John Lennon tribute on the 11th, and we've got the hits from the musical on the 18th. We've got the Christmas special on the 25th on Christmas Day, and we've got the Viennese New Year's celebration on the 1st. And they're all streamed on rte.ie/culture at 7 p.m. on Friday evenings, which I'm sure you can get them after as well.
Yeah, of course. And then you can settle down to the late at 9:30. So that's great. You can go in, have the gig in your kitchen at 7 o'clock.
Wherever.
Put on your tie.
Yeah.
Make an event of it. No, seriously.
You don't have to put on your tie.
You just want to make it really relaxed.
Really relaxed with your tie on.
Have a glass of something nice.
Yeah, a glass of something nice is good.
Treat yourself. Treat it like it's a night out, but it's a night in. Yeah. And this is the likes of, will we play a little Killian Donnelly?
Play the fantastic Killian Donnelly.
And Mairéad O'Mahony.
And Mairéad O'Mahony, yeah.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing you can expect to hear.
This is on the 18th, on the hits from the musicals.
Oh, beautiful. That's a Friday night. Johnny Mathis. I'll trade you Andrew Lloyd Webber for Johnny Mathis. We're talking about mum. Dave was like, what do you like that music? I actually really like this, but it reminds me of my mother. It was mum music, you know. She had read the vinyl album of Andrew Lloyd Webber's greatest hits, Another Suitcase in Another Hall, you know, Evita, all that sort
of
thing.
It was different in my house my mother had was into Johnny Mathis. She had a Johnny Mathis Christmas LP that was taken on Christmas morning.
There's nothing wrong with that.
At 11. It was fantastic. It was gorgeous. That she did make things a bit more Christmassy than normal. You know, like, so that was
Killian Donnelly and Mairéad O'Mahony there singing, and then All I Ask of You from Phantom of the Opera. And that's the kind of, that's lovely. I mean, you can't go wrong with a bit of that.
They're all the hits from the musicals. You're going to hear all them on the 18th.
We love that. Can I ask you how you are?
I mean, you're asking me this for a reason, Ryan. Word has spread.
The word has spread. It's like a children's book title. The conductor, the bike, and the Lewis track.
I fell off my bike. I'm such an idiot.
No.
It's. I feel like an idiot because I wasn't this way hit by a car, or I did something stupid. I did do something stupid. I was a couple of weeks ago, last Wednesday fortnight, I was turning around. I cycle everywhere in Dublin. It's the only way to travel for me, I have done for years. Mm. And I'm not a kind of COVID cycler, somebody who when the things.
Yeah, you're not one of those.
And which of course it's great that those people are out cycling. And so I've been cycling for years. And then 2 weeks ago, I was just leaving rehearsal at the NSO in the National Concert Hall, and I was turning from Stephen's Green down Dawson Street, and it's a tricky junction because the Lewis tracks are coming up around up Dawson Street, and it had just been raining, and my front wheel decided to get very intimate with the Lewis track, and it got stuck in the Lewis track, and I went for a sevener
and landed.
Well, I kind of landed because I just pulled away from a green light, so I wasn't going fast. If I was going faster, probably momentum would have taken me through the track, you know. But and I landed on my left scapula, but on the corner of the curb. So I caught the corner of the curb and I could hear the crack straight away, and so that wasn't good. So so I kind of need my left scapula. It's kind of important.
Conducting is enormously physical, right?
It is a physical thing, yeah. And so I do feel a bit like I'm flying on one wing at the moment.
Finding Nemo.
Yeah, and I actually was recording with the Concert Orchestra the week after, and I was talking to Joe Chibi, the general manager of the Concert Orchestra.
Yes,
and I said, Joe, I can do like a one hand. My right hand is completely fine. My left hand will be limited. And he said, yeah, let's do it. Let's go for it, you know. So it's been interesting.
Didn't Def Leppard have a one-arm drummer?
That's true.
So
come on. And actually, was it Def Leppard? Was he the guy who had two pedal bass drums as well? There was two pedals.
I don't know enough now. I was spoofing on the first bit, so I can't take it any further.
Maybe
than
I'm
that.
Spoofing now. So, I come off the bike, and so it'll be a few more weeks before I'm fully back. But every day I get more movement, and I'm fine. Like, I'm grand.
Can I ask you something about your younger self that I found really intriguing? No, the reason I ask is because obviously I'm in toy mode and kids and Christmas, but also because I've really admired what you've done with the homeless choir and the carers choir. And there's a streak in you, David, that even though I don't know you particularly well, but anytime I meet you, I always like you, which strikes me as being very kind, thoughtful and empathetic. And when I heard about maybe this, it kind of put a lot of things in context. You had a tough go of it in school as a boy. And could you tell me, it was an all-boys school, right?
Why was it so awful for you?
God.
We didn't expect this, but I
wasn't expecting this at all. Like,
go for it. Do you mind me asking?
Yeah,
you?
No problem. I was in an all boys school in, I grew up in Santry. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Our Lady Victories on Ballymun Road and all boys school. I went to St. Aidan's in Whitehall. And I just assumed there was two people in the world. There were those who were bullied and those who bullied. That was it. You know, there was, I didn't get the impression there was people who just went through life, who were just left alone, you know. So I kind of, it was rough in primary school, and I've got stupendous ears.
How rough was it?
And I was slagged off for horrendously on them, you know. And it was rough. I found it difficult.
Did you get beaten up?
Oh God, a lot.
Why?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I presume I was different. And of course, the fact like I played piano and I sang in a choir, like I joined the Greenfield Singers when I was 11. I mean, they were all, you're definitely gay because you know, you play the piano and you do classical music. And then also I remember I got slagged off because my father gave me, this sounds terrible, but he gave me his sister's old, you know, the old music cases with the bar that goes over, like they, you know, and you can just see in a particular context, you know. Mm. You know, I always think back to Woody, you know, Woody Allen films where they do flashbacks to him when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And there's always shots of him and somebody takes his glasses off, puts them on the floor and steps on his glasses, you know. Well, I kind of felt a lot like that kind of when I was younger.
Was it relentless?
I felt it was relentless. Mm. It might not have been, you know, but I felt it was relentless. And so I don't know. I mean, obviously that kind of shaped me, the type of person I was. And I probably became, like most teenagers, quite introverted, I'd say.
Did you talk to your folks, or were you embarrassed about it, or how did you?
No, I think my folks were very aware of it and very good about it, extremely good about it. Yeah. But I think there's only so much your folks can do.
Yeah, but you're
that,
a dad,
you know?
Now. I mean, and have been for a number of years. But I just think when you're in the event of your child being in any way worried about the world, or whether it's anxiety or if there's a bullying situation, there's a terrible degree of helplessness.
It's very difficult, you know, because you as a parent you rely, because you're not in the school. If it's happening in school, you're not in the school. You don't know what's going on, you know. And for me, it was like. Like I used to kind of wake in the morning and I know I'd say to my mother sometimes, I've got a sore tummy, and I really did not want to go to school.
Yeah.
And it was, I kind of did, especially in primary school, not so much in secondary school, especially in primary school, I would have this feeling in my tummy in the morning, I'm going to go into this again where I'm going to have another day of kind of relentless bullying and being picked on, you know. And but there's nothing you can do as a parent. Mm. There's very little you can do, and you do rely on the school. I know my folks went to the school and kind of said, like, you know, this is kind of not on, you know. But I had a guy when I was about 10, there was a guy in my, and he wasn't in my class, he was in the school though, who repeatedly threatened to hang me.
Oh, good
for gosh. Like not just 6 months, but for a couple of years. And of course, I was probably 9 or 10 at the time. I utterly believed it. Utterly believed it.
Of course
it,
you did.
And so you don't recover from that very easily, you know. And that doesn't leave you. You know, so when somebody says to you, you know, I'm going to hang you, and you're like 9 or 10. And
any idea of why you? I've asked you that before already.
I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned your ears, which are pretty much the same Arwell gene pool as my own. You know, but also you have to survive that then. You don't want to be a burden on your folks and your family, and you don't want to be seen again. So you become the introvert like you describe it. How did it stop, or how did you?
When I was in secondary school, and it comes to that time after the, well, for me was the intercert, and you kind of say, what are you going to do with your life, and you know, what's your career you're going to do? I was adamant I wasn't going to college because I saw the college of being like more like school, you know. And then I eventually did go to the College of Music, and when I left school, like I would say, my life began. I was going, oh, this is the world where you can go and be in a classroom with other people, and then not get slagged all day long.
And females.
So that was the first time
as well.
And females, I'm a great believer in co-ed, you know.
Yeah.
I think, you know, because I had no sisters.
Yeah.
So if you spend every day with boys all the time and you've no sisters, you're in a bit of a difficult situation when you get to 17 or 18, you know. Mm. So I went to college and then my life began. I was kind of going, okay, this is like, this is great. I actually don't spend the rest of my life getting slagged off, and I don't get to spend the rest of my life getting bullied or
amazing.
Abused.
I think that, and thank you for talking to us about that, because that's I think it's really interesting that, you know, it to me it informs why you have such a kind streak in you.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
the way you deal with people
I would say it's complex, and I'd say probably only the past few years that I'd be kind of willing to admit that kind of bullying and what I put up with in school probably shapes a little bit of who the person I am nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, and probably for many years through my 20s and probably all my 30s, I wouldn't have even referred to it, you know. But maybe I think just for some reason the past few years, I think I've kind of, even for myself, said, actually, this was a thing that happened to you, Dave, when you were younger, and actually is part of your life.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of shaped the person I am now, for good or bad. It has had,
well,
an
for good,
on me, you
I
know?
Think.
And it doesn't, well, not all the time, you know, but like everyone has their good and bad
That's
points,
true.
You know. But I think it's only in the past number of years where I kind of felt, you know, okay, this is a real thing that happened to you. And it never goes away.
It's
just, I certainly remember, you know, I will never forget all the occasions when one of the kids said to me, I'm going to hang you. And to leave and to come home and to, you know, as all kids, everyone lives with their own thoughts and lives in their own heads. And you come home, and I said to my folks, but, you know, it doesn't leave you. And your folks, my folks were fantastic, and they reassured you all the time. But then you meet the same person a few weeks later and do the same thing. And they know they're having an impact on you because they know that you're vulnerable in some way. And that's what it's about, you know. But when you utterly believe it, and I did many days and I was terrified.
I think for people listening this morning.
And
one thing
I want to say, David, Ryan, is that this is going on today.
That's... Yep.
Probably what you were going to say.
No, go on.
This is going on today. I mean, I saw something, I saw something on RT over a year ago, and there was a teenager. She must have been about 15 or 16. I don't even know what the program was. And she was living in Finglas or something. And she was saying she was scared to go on the bus after 6 o'clock in the evening, you know, because she's going to get bullied. And this type of thing goes on today. And we, you know, we just.
It's a scourge.
It's a scourge.
And it happens to adults in workplaces.
It happens to adults all the time.
But worse, again, to children.
Yeah.
And that's why you talking about it today helps matters, because people will say to their children, look, you know, it's tough. You can still turn out to be a good person.
Yeah, well, probably in a weird way, like as a conductor, you kind of have to. When I'm in front of an orchestra of like 50, 60, 70 players, you kind of have to sometimes hold firm against lots of different opinions coming at you and things that way people play, you know. So I think maybe a little bit of resolve that I managed to gain in my childhood and teenage years possibly has helped me in my life.
Did David ever confront or meet his bullies in later years?
No, although it has really... I've thought about that a lot.
Have you really?
Have I? If I'd met that person, I don't even know what that person's name is, you know.
Yeah.
But I've never met anybody.
Sometimes the bully wants to come back and say sorry many years later, funny enough, rather than the victim.
I understand that. And I understand also that I have no idea about that person and what their life was like when they were bullying me. I have no idea. And I'm sure there were good reasons at the time.
That's a very generous thing to say.
No, I'm a great believer in people.
Mm.
No matter who the person is, I'm sure the people who bullied me and I was in the same, I'm sure God knows what their lives were like. You know,
they generally come from a.
You just don't know, and I don't want to make any assumptions at all. But you just don't know, and I would, you know, I think I like to think I'm somebody who gives people the benefit of the doubt, and I believe that there's goodness in everybody, you know. So I mean, you know, you talk about people come back to apologise. Yeah, I mean, I would have that conversation, but I've never met
intriguing who... Sir Adrian Bolt used to control enormous orchestras with only his right hand and a stick.
That's great.
His stick technique was legendary.
No, his
I remember says the text seeing him conduct Mahler's Symphony of 1,000 with his right hand.
What a great text. I love it. Whoever sent that in, that's great.
A real Radio 1 text right there.
Yeah, I love it. But he, like, I think Adrian Bolt used a baton that was like the size of a six iron, like a golf club. Like, it was huge, I think. You know, he didn't have to do anything else, you know. So.
The RTE Concert Orchestra Winter Sessions, an RTE Concert Orchestra collaboration with the RDS, will be broadcast on RT Lyric FM and streamed on rte.ie/culture Fridays at 7, the 11th of December to the 1st of January. That is just what the world needs and just what the country needs, and led from the top by no better man than yourself, David Brophy. Thank you for coming in to see us.
Thanks, Ryan.
for such candid chats. And to you and your family, happy Christmas.
Thanks a million. I appreciate
Get the
it.
Johnny Mathis album out.
You listen, I want to ask you a question.
Go on.
What, on Friday night, you were doing Singing in the Rain.
I did Singing in the Rain.
Is that you singing? Was that your voice?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Because I was listening to it and I was saying, that's not offensive.
Yeah, because every year it's offensive. Offensive. But because
no,
it was...
No, I don't I mean said, that. No, I know. But I was listening to it and going, and I actually turned up the volume saying, I wonder, is that him?
Yeah, it is.
And it actually is you. And I'm kind of going... That's kind of, it's pleasant. You should do more of it, Paz, potentially. You should. Like,
I sang
amazing.
Under controlled conditions. That, normally it's in studio and you're huffing and puffing and panting or whatever. But so we did it in better conditions. But
what do you mean controlled auto-tune? Is that what you mean by controlled conditions?
By controlled conditions, somebody else did. No.
It was great.
No,
I enjoyed it. I was kind of going, this is nice.
Thank
it's
you,
pleasant.
David. Thank you, David.
I'm not just saying that, actually. You know,
I was laughing. I knew that it wasn't great when the guys who were there watching me. I know it was all right, but the guys watching me were said
that. I've heard a lot worse.
Here's what they said after. God, fair play to you, Ryan. You can whistle.
Okay.
David, thanks a million.
Thank you, Ryan. Happy Christmas to you.
And to you. 9:24. I didn't mean to make the mascara run there with Dolly. I just thought it was a beautiful song. Let me welcome our guest this morning, Dawn French. What a pleasure it is to say good morning to you.
Oh, good morning to you and everybody that's listening. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. Are you a Dolly fan?
Oh, huge. And in fact, Jennifer and I have been to see Dolly many times in concert and given each other the tickets as a bit of a treat. And let me tell you something, Ryan. Jennifer knows Dolly quite well and had dinner with her in LA when she was being all posh and doing some TV show over there, some little show called Friends, I think it was. And then she went out with Dolly and Dolly at the table was leaving half of the food on the side of her plate.
Yes.
And Jennifer said, oh, what? Do you not eat all your food? And she said, no, this half, well, you know, in a Dolly accent, which I can't do. This half is for me and this half is for the angels. And Jennifer said, oh, okay, good diet technique. And then you'll have to get this right with Jennifer, but this is how I remember it from Jennifer telling me. Dolly showed Jennifer a tattoo she has on the front that goes up amongst her bosoms.
Now, that is a revelation to me.
Oh, yes. Maybe you can ask Dolly about
this This changes everything.
I know. I mean, maybe it was just a dream Jennifer had. It could be that.
It sounds kind of trippy.
I'm joining her in that dream. I'm joining her.
It's good to talk. You're a busy woman. My goodness, you have so much going on. I love that. You live quite near... You're kind of Daphne du Maurier country, are you, Dawn?
I definitely am, yeah.
That would make great sense for you as a writer.
Definitely. Well, it's where I'm from. It's where my family are from. And I returned there about 16 years ago. And without a doubt, one of my intentions was to be able to write more rather than be in front of the camera. Wanted to be sitting quietly there on the very bay, actually, where du Maurier lived, funnily enough.
Really? And does it, this might be an odd question, but does it lend itself to a writer's life in terms of the good air, the almost, I don't know if it's as creepy as du Maurier's books were, but is it beautiful and inspirational?
It definitely is. Do you know what I think it is? It's a simple thing, and this will apply to anywhere particularly beautiful and remote.
Yeah.
Is that it's just a big sky and fresh air and birds flying above you and peace and hearing the sea. All of that just calms your mind. And when your mind is calm like that, that's when you can let in all the people, you know, that you're going to write about.
So according to the record, you're up of a morning at 7, you walk the dogs. Have you done that today already?
Have not, because I'm sitting in London.
Cornwall. I for some reason I had you in Cornwall. Okay, you're on the circuit at the moment. And how many dogs do you have?
I have one dog, one cat.
Okay, names?
That's all I deserve, by the way. name of dog, Goody. Name of cat, Mauser.
And breeds of same?
Oh, I'm glad you're so interested. This is great. The dog is a Parsons Jack Russell Terrier.
A Parsons Jack Russell Terrier?
A Parsons Jack Russell, which is like a Jack Russell with long legs.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they were named after some parson that bred them, you know, in the 1800s.
Good Lord.
But they're very elegant little, cheeky little dogs. And in fact, I wanted a very scruffy one. And we went to the breeder who... Yeah. Found me the scruffy bitch, the scruffy dog, and said, definitely, if we put these two together, you'll get a scruffy dog, and of course I don't. I have a smooth-haired one. I have the mistake.
Did you know? I want to bounce towards your new book because of you. Because in the 1950s, in Ireland, there were about 3 famous baby abduction cases in Dublin.
And
the babies were taken out from outside what would be the kind of equivalent of our Harrods or what have you, just snatched, and they ended up in Belfast. And the reason I say this is because your book is, while it's not outside a shop, obviously it's in a maternity hospital, the idea of having a baby snatched at birth is at once terrifying but equally captivating. And this is where you've come to for your book, and I'm curious to know why.
Well, you know, I wanted to write a book this time that had at the centre of it a crime that would seemingly be unforgivable. Mm. With, the character, the woman who snatches that baby at the beginning of my book, how could you ever forgive her? Surely you couldn't. But it's my job as the writer to challenge myself to see if we can understand this woman, wrap our understanding around her and wrap our forgiveness around her. So I have, at the very beginning of this book, 2 very different women in the same maternity ward on the same night giving birth, and they both give birth to a baby daughter.
Yes.
And the very next morning, one of them leaves the hospital with a daughter and one doesn't. And the one who leaves has stolen the other woman's baby. So that's where we start. But of course, that's just the beginning. Really, what I want to do is see this child grow up. And that was a real treat to write the entire lifetime of a young woman growing from 0 to 18 and bonding with her mother, or who she thinks is her mother, who is her mother, as it happens. And then finding out, you know, what happens when you discover that your life is nothing like you thought it was, when somebody takes the rug from underneath you. And really, I guess I want to explore themes of identity and belonging and family and what we're made of, whether we're made of, you know, our DNA, or whether we're made of who's there for us and who steps up for us. That's what interested me. And I wanted to write this unforgivable crime at the centre of it and see if we could forgive that woman.
Yeah, very much so. And like everything in life, it is not simply the Nazis versus the Allies. It's not cut and dry. It's complicated. It's nuanced.
Yes, she took
the baby, but the part of you suddenly finds yourself going, but she took it because, you know, even though
that's
it was
right.
So utterly wrong.
She took it because.
Right.
And I also wanted to have a sort of moral dilemma,
right,
which is, did that baby actually, by dint of being stolen by that woman, did that baby end up in the right family after all?
That's right. I mean,
are we to say?
This is the sort of maternal sliding doors, if you like. I mean, who knows? And that this is the conundrum, I suppose, to an extent, for people who are adopted. I say this respectfully to birth parents and adoptive families and the children involved, when they hit a certain age and go, I just need to know. And they can say, well, it's for medical records, and that's fine, because a large amount of time it is, and that features in your book. But a lot of the time it's just innate curiosity.
Absolutely. I mean, and we would imagine, wouldn't we, that everybody who wonders about their identity and their ancestry and their heritage and their tribe or whatever you want to call it, we imagine that everybody who's adopted would want that. And it's not the case, Ryan. It's not the case that everybody searches for that. Some people are content in their life and the understanding of what's come before. But, you know, I've adopted a daughter and who at the moment has, you know, she's nearly 30. At the moment, this is not of interest to her. However, the doors are open for that in the future. And my own mum was a remarkable woman who was involved with adoption, because she was on the panel. She worked with Children's Services a lot. And so my mum told me many, many stories of adopted and fostered kids, and all the wonderful stories that you hardly ever hear of. And occasionally the more difficult stories where people go searching or maybe find things they don't want to find do find, you know, and connect up and connect the dots of their own lives, if you like. The anatomy of a family is an extraordinary thing to explore, isn't it?
Oh, it's such, we're all complicated novels, as we say. But, you know, in your case, did you ever think, OK, when my daughter comes the time, if in the event that she wants to find
her birth mother. Do you think that that will be difficult for you, Dawn, or do you think you're well prepped for it now, 30 years on?
Do you know, I prepped for it 30 years ago, and I've been processing that ever since. Yeah, because that's the deal with an adopted kid. That's the contract, the moral contract you make, which is I will support you in everything you need to do because these are exceptional circumstances. But there are many people to protect. There's my daughter to protect, and there's also that birth mother who I don't know, but I love very much, and I have a lot to be thankful for. And I need to protect her choices also. So, you know, it's a complicated old thing that you that changes, you know, it's a sort of febrile thing that just it's elastic and it moves all the time. But I'm just my promise as the adopted mum is to support any decision made by my daughter. That's my promise, and I'll do it whatever happens.
I'd say your heart breaks. Sometimes we talk to people on the show about adopting and being adopted, what have you, and I often think that probably the most difficulty is when they do meet, the adopted child eventually meets the birth mother or father, and when it's the opposite of magnetic. Chemistry
isn't
there.
Well, you know, those kids risk a second rejection, which is, you know, a mighty old catastrophe for them to live with. But also there are many wonderful stories, and don't forget about all the love that's involved actually adopting.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, in many instances, these kids have come into the lives of people who really want them very much. So it can be a really viscerally marvellous experience because, you know, you're longing for a child. And that really is at the centre of this book as well, the mother love.
Absolutely.
Is a strong line that goes, it's a deep dive into that.
It sure is. And this, it's a fairly modern expression. Don't know if I love it, but it makes huge sense, is the blended family. You have two, what are called stepchildren, but essentially they're your children, as you call them, and in real life, as I say. And so That is the modern way in so many respects, and it's the healthy way, and it's the kind way, and it's the loving way.
It is. Well, all you have to do is be kind, as you say. You know, you have to navigate your way through this complicated, you know, it's a bit of a minefield, can be, definitely. I mean, they are my stepchildren, but I am absolutely respectful and mindful of their mum. And, you know, I was not in their early life. She made them. You know, I completely understand that. But as long as you give your kids the freedom to make all kinds of choices and you don't get in the way of it, you don't blame them or add any kind of guilt or anything to any choices that they make, then you just stand back and go, okay, just decide. Yeah. I mean, here we are coming up to Christmas. And every Christmas, what we say is, look, where is it best for you to be? You decide. You guys decide. They're adults. You know, they can decide. And we all kind of look after each other in a bigger way. You know, that's the way to try. Just try and be as kind as you can.
That's
I'm not saying it's, you know, problem free. Of course it's not. But, you know, so long as everybody knows that the intention is kindness, that's OK with me.
I agree with you. Let me ask you a few other things, because you're so busy with I'm just intrigued about this story about Roald Dahl meeting. I'm a big Dahl fan, so forgive me for dwelling on meeting Beatrix Potter. What in the name of goodness is this?
Did you know that that had happened?
No, I didn't know that. I thought they were
neither
from different eras.
Yeah, I mean, how amazing. He was 6 years old. And if you know about Roald, you'll know that, you know, his dad had died, his sister had died. He'd had a really horrible, difficult life, even up to the age of six. And his mum knew that he was a big Beatrix Potter fan. That was his favourite. That was his favourite literature at that young age. And so she took him to Beatrix Potter's house. And I think she was only intending that he would be able to see it. But of course, he wanted to find Peter Rabbit. So he went into her garden and he did meet her. And this was only a matter of minutes. And probably with the seemingly, from all the research, quite grumpy Beatrix, who was fed up of children coming up into her garden. Probably this wasn't the most loving of encounters, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But he did meet her. And she did meet him. I mean, she did not know she's meeting the future Roald Dahl, but he certainly met his heroine. And of course, in a drama like this, written by this wonderful girl called Abby Wilson, you know, she's managed to make this little moment where they met a proper seismic moment in both of their lives that kind of changed the. And if you look at Roald's writing, you can see the influence of Beatrix, actually.
Yeah.
And lots of people believe that Beatrix was, you know, cuddly. because of the way that the animals look that she drew. But anything but. In Beatrix's literature, you know, rats get their tails cut off, you know, rats eat kittens. I mean, Mr. McGregor was going to put Peter Rabbit in a pie. There's no doubt about it. You know, and the sort of horror is there to be seen, as it is in Roald Dahl's writing.
It is. The dark side raises a brief, but that's, you know, reflects real life too. It's not all a bed of roses as well, you know.
So. No, definitely not. And kids are the best at dealing with that kind of horror.
Yeah.
And that's what Roald Dahl knew, and that's what Beatrix Potter knew, is that they can deal with it. And there was nothing more horrific, was there, than Roald's actual real life at that age. His real life was full of darkness and difficult stuff. So, you know, he loved Beatrix's writing, and good on him. It's a beautiful film. It's got animation in it. It's very Christmassy and all
Sounds
of that.
Gorgeous. That's Christmas Eve,
It's full of heart. And, you know, one of the clever things that they've done is make sure that many of the characters in there reference either Roald's writing or Beatrix's writing. So Bill Bailey plays a gentleman that the young Roald meets on a train station. And if you look a bit closer, you're seeing the BFG, you know. You know, there's lots of little references.
Lovely.
It's very beautiful.
Christmas Eve at 8 o'clock on Sky One. That's one I'll be glued to. Wonderful. Love the sound of that. I'm also very excited about, as an Agatha Christie and a Kenneth Branagh fan, There You Are in Death on the Nile. I'm very excited about it. That is great stuff now. You're really bringing us all the joy of this Christmas, Dawn. Tell me.
Well, you know, that is a giant film, but we made it a year ago. And of course, you know, who can release a great big Hollywood blockbuster like that at the moment with nobody going to the cinema? So, you know, they've held on to it and held on to it. But, and I've only seen glimpses of it, bits where I've done, you know, ADR sound work and stuff like that on it and a trailer. But oh my goodness, it's so slick. It's so sexy. It's completely sizzling. And what a fantastic guy Ken Branagh is to work for. I mean, not only has he got a major twinkle, but he is such a, and he's very cheeky, but he is such a consummate director, because of course he's an actor.
Yes.
So in this film, not only is he giving us his marvellous Poirot with the great big moustache, slightly smaller this year than the one before.
Oh, right, OK.
That took over a little bit. but he's also the director, you know, he's the director, he's the lead actor, he's the producer, and he's the person that you want to please on the set. Oh, my goodness, I've never gone to a set, albeit a giant, great, big Nile cruiser built to scale, you know, like big Hollywood film set, amazing. You go to that set prepared. You know your lines. You've got your correct shoes on. You don't muck about. You could, but you don't, because you want to raise your game for Ken. You want to give him the best possible performance you can. And it's a great story. And Jennifer and I recreate the characters that were played in, you know, in the one that was made, was it in the 70s?
Yes.
With Bette Midler and Maggie Smith playing these
Bette
parts.
Bette Davis and the whole lot. Yeah, it'll be mad.
Bette Davis, that's right, not Bette Midler. Why am I saying that?
No, but do you and Jennifer have not an obsession with, but an overweening fascination with whatever happened to Baby Jane? Like, I mean,
I know why you're saying that.
Well, I mean, there's a few reasons. There are a few reasons, Dawn. What is it about that film? I mean, it is bonkers,
well, because,
obviously.
You know, in our terminology, it's gagging for it. That's why.
What does that mean? No, explain that, please.
Well, it just screams, please take the miss out of me, you know, doesn't it? yes, and we've done that a few times, very definitely. But we recently have done a play, and we didn't give it that title. But David Quantick has written a very funny play that Jennifer and I have done that's going to be on the radio at Christmas.
And it's called?
It's called Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen.
Very clever. Yeah. I like that. I like that, of course. And you're also going to be featuring on The Vicar of Dibley back on the screens here. That runs in Ireland. Massive. I'll read some text to you in a second now, but that's got a huge fan base here as well. So maybe
explain to
your fans what's happening there, Dawn.
Well, you know, we knew that the BBC were going to repeat some of the Vicars sort of leading up to Christmas. And I understand why they do. I've had lots of feedback from people during this terrible time that it's very comforting TV. And I'm delighted to hear that. So the BBC were going to repeat some. And we thought, well, you know, rather than just having the repeats, let's also film some new stuff. So what would Geraldine be doing during the lockdown? She would be ministering to her parishioners via webcam. That's what she'd be doing.
As is happening in churches around Ireland. Absolutely.
Yes, Exactly. So, you know, we've managed to make a 9 little tiny films of her zooming her parishioners all the way from the beginning of the lockdown in March all the way up to Christmas. So you see all the different changes in the restrictions. And, you know, when we go out, when we're eventually allowed to go out, we take Geraldine out with on her phone camera walking through Dibley, and we were back in Turville where we shot it originally, right. And I was back with James Bleet, who plays Hugo Horton. And, you know, as we always do with Dibley, Dibley can be quite political. Dibley can be very fuzzy and comforting and lovely, but it can also be very real. So there's part of this where we pay a tribute to Alice, who is gone, of course. And it's a difficult thing, isn't it, when you're in a well-loved sitcom like that, where there's a character that is also very well-loved, and we know that the actress has gone. So we need to kind of mesh the two together, and I do a little eulogy to her, which was not easy to film, hasten to add. And of course, as Geraldine is talking about Alice, so too is Dawn talking about Emma. So, you know, and the audience know that, and that imbues it all with all of our love.
Oh, we're all on the cusp of tears the last few weeks as this bizarre year draws to an end. How have you been, Dawn?
I've been good, actually, because I am lucky enough to live in a beautiful place in Cornwall. I've got a lovely family, and it kind of drew us together. We all made a decision, right, let's hunker down together.
Good.
So I had both of my daughters with me. My son was just up the road. But, you know, we had times that we wouldn't ordinarily have. And I think a lot of people have experienced this, you know, where we had our moments that were tense, and I was quite anxious. But in the company of my daughters, having a big laugh and cooking far too much macaroni cheese and watching Drag Race on the telly and, you know, playing games to board games together and having celebrations of birthdays and stuff, having to make do inside the house was actually great. And we came through it as a very loving family. So I'm grateful in a funny way for that, because I think you've got to find the learning, haven't you,
in
all of these difficult moments. And we did do that. But I'm not. And I was also very lucky that at that time I was due to be work-wise. I was due to be writing the second draft of this book because of you. And so I was able to be doing my normal job at the normal time in a normal way in my house. So that was comforting for me. You know, meanwhile, of course, I was watching the future work that was a tour and other theatre work and stuff just disappear, just fall off a cliff. Like for so many people in this industry, it was that bit was very frightening. But we're going to get through it, Ryan. We're all going to get through it. And we'll be changed in a good way.
I hope so. And I think you're right. The cavalry is coming, as has been said. And even funny, because our lockdown's kind of lifting marginally in the next few days, and you can go to a restaurant or whatever. And I spoke to a number of people who said, I'm kind of nervous about going to meet friends because it's been 9 months, and I kind of was enjoying the solitude, strangely, almost like Stockholm syndrome with the pandemic. Yeah. You know, you're kind of almost enjoying the forced isolation. For some, obviously.
Yeah, well, hunkering down. Hunkering down is cosy, and getting out of your tight clothes and into your loose clothes is cosy. And it's quite hard to gear up again, but we all will, because we are longing for human contact. That's what we want. And we want our music back.
Yeah, and our theatre, as you say. And
want to be in the company of those that enrich us, you know. And we, you know, look at it. We've, since the beginning of time, you know, man has obviously had to find food and water and shelter, but we've also told stories and danced and sung. And so for me, it's a human need just as strong as any other. So, yeah, that's what I'm longing for is, you know, I tell you something. When we did the Beatrix and Rold film, because we were all tested as actors to go on the set, and Rob Brydon plays my husband in that. And I had to hug him on the first day of filming. And it felt very strange because I hadn't hugged anyone for months except for people in my family. And I actually held on to him and I said, I'm really sorry, Rob, but I've got to do this for longer than is comfortable, because it just feels so blooming good.
Oh, isn't it amazing? Mary Rooney from Rathcoole in Dublin said, I love, love, love Dawn French, and I watch The Victor of Dibley all the time. It never ages. Thank you, Dawn, and rock on. Another love Dawn French says, Denise, I still love watching her in The Victor of Dibley, a brilliant show and a very talented lady. Another says, please ask the wonderful Dawn French if
Rumours of a return, but we've just covered that. Don't worry about that. And Kira says, I'm a huge fan of Dawn's. I'm dying to get her book. I follow her on Twitter and her pictures of Cornwall are amazing. I love Dawn French's Teresa. She's straight up gorgeous. Her heart shines in this sweet interview. Yes to kindness. Yes to listening to your kids. Looking forward to her book. So hardworking. And I had never heard about Roald Dahl and Beatrix Potter meeting Oh, to be a fly on the wall. Which you wouldn't want to be, because either one of them would have swatted you and probably killed you. So
that's true. Then drawn you
and I've
written
a whole novel about it. Okay, listen, Dawn, it's been a real pleasure. We'll do it again in real life when the...
Absolutely. Love talking to you, Ryan. Yeah,
likewise.
Always.
Really nice to see you. To you and your family, happy Christmas. And congratulations on the book.
Okay.
All the
Thanks,
best. Thanks,
guys.
Dawn.
Thank you so much.
Dawn French joining us live from London, as it happens. And Because of You is the novel that... Like I said, will resonate with a lot of people listening in this morning, that story. And it gets into serious drama, by the way, and quite a thriller. And we couldn't talk too much about it because the latter half and into the end is too easy to give away. So, that's a dramatic book. And again, from the pen of Dawn French, called Because of You. What a lovely person. 9:28 this Thursday morning, and I want to welcome you to Arthur and Deborah Carr. Good morning, Arthur and Deborah. Nice of you to join us this morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
Morning, Ryan.
And thanks for being with us. You're in Galway. How's Galway City today? Tell me.
It's a bit drizzly, and the traffic is terrible.
But you know something, part the traffic bit, but walking through Shop Street on a drizzly Thursday morning, you could do worse things.
Absolutely.
You could do worse things. Thanks for coming in to see us anyway today, and... I'd love you to tell us a bit about Clada Watch and why it's required. So maybe one of you take the lead there.
Well, Clada Watch was set up in 2019.
Yeah.
Our first patrol was on the 5th of July, and we've been out every weekend since. Our aim is to prevent accidental deaths and suicides on the rivers of Galway and the waters of Galway.
What's desperately sad about that is that you're not the only people doing something like this in waterways around Ireland. And the fact is that the fact that it's needed at all says something terrible about what's happening out there. Could you kind of enlighten us a little as to what is happening out there? How has it come to this?
Well, originally, I suppose, January 19, mm-hmm. I think we lost 5 people inside a week. And out of those, I think there was 3 that were accidental deaths. And we decided that we had to do something because unnecessary deaths are just not acceptable in society. And we spoke to various people, and I suppose we set up and we based ourselves on a very, very successful organisation down in the southeast called Wexford Marine Watch. They were enormous help to us and guided us and actually even gave us a lot of gear to get us going at the very outset, you know.
And when you're on a Clada watch, do you work together when you're on the watch, or do you work with different volunteers?
We have, I think, on our books 87 volunteers.
Really?
At the moment. Okay. Yeah. Very, very dedicated crew. I think we're very, very lucky. We go out in groups of 2. Mm-hmm. And we have, I suppose, very unique city that all the other counties and towns and cities that have these set up, they have one river flowing through the middle.
Yes.
But in Galway, we have in excess of 22 kilometres of water within the city. So, and a lot of that is unprotected. So that's our job, is to try and guide people away from the rivers as much as possible.
It's a strange thing to bring up, but I will. In a beautiful Christmas movie that I adore called It's a Wonderful Life, it actually begins in some ways with James Stewart as George Bailey looking at the flowing water and thinking, I don't think it was worth it, I'm out of here. And it's desperately sad because he's going, what do I do? And thankfully for him, a mysterious figure comes along and says, hang on a second. Jack actually jumps in and drags him out to dry their clothes, and so begins this magical tale. In some ways, you're the Clarence to this piece, whereby, you know where I'm going with this. Yeah, you will see somebody maybe looking at that flowing water and thinking, where to from here? What do you do when you see somebody contemplating their very existence?
Our job is to approach them, and the initial conversation is very simple. It's, you know, are you all right there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can I help you? So there's no big kind of plan as regards removing them from the water. What you're doing is just asking them a very simple, basic question of humanity. Are you okay? And it might just be that they are a little bit disorientated. Maybe they've had a few drinks and you can move them on, maybe find their friends for them. Other people are a bit more vulnerable. So we are looking for people that are disorientated, you know, that don't maybe look themselves. Mm-hmm. And you're approaching them, asking them they're okay. You're moving them away from the water. And in the event that you feel that they need more help, then you're looking for the blue light services. You're either calling the ambulance or the fire brigade or the Gardaí.
So you pass them on to
We do. So we keep them safe. We keep them safe for the few minutes that we have them.
Yes.
And it's generally a conversation that we have with them, first and foremost. You know, we have so many different incidences of so many different levels. And what we do is we just keep them safe. You know, that's the aim. We have so many different volunteers with so many different skills. Mm. They come from every background, Ryan. You wouldn't believe it. Mm. We have from the late teens to retirees. We have professionals, non-professionals. We have slightly more women than men. We have quite a lot of women that are, say, over the age of 40. And they're so amazing. They give up a minimum of one night a month. That's all we ask. We just ask them to do one night a month. And if they want to do more, they can. Mm. So we have a team of about 10 people that go out a couple of nights a week, the busiest nights. We divide them into teams of two or three, and out they go. They walk the long walk in Galway. They do Nemo's Pier. They do up around the back of the Roisin Dhubh. They go anywhere that they feel is a hot spot, you know, unfortunately. And there are a few hot spots that are well known.
And people are very generous with their time.
Extraordinary.
And
I mean,
hearts,
they get off their sofa at 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening to head out into the west of Ireland weather.
Yeah.
The cold, the breeze, you know, and the rain. And they do it they give so much. I'm so impressed by them.
No, it's actually gorgeous to hear about that. And Arthur, I remember on the Late Late Show, Blind Boy Boat Club was talking about a few years ago, and he made quite an impact with one comment that he made, which was that he's fed up with hearing stories of young people throwing themselves into the rivers because they were, you know, mental health issues and depression and worried about the world. Do you see that? Do you, like, for people who do want to end their lives and die by suicide, do they tell you why, or is that something for another day?
Well, we do hear stories. You know, it can be quite difficult. The approach that we do make, it's very non-invasive, and you know, the communications is to try and calm somebody down as much as possible, make them safe, because we're not professionals. You know, we're all, as Deborah says, we're from all walks of life. We're not counsellors, or we're not social workers. We hand them over to the services that are required at the time. And the stories do come out. We try and distance ourselves from that, because at the end of the day, we can't be taking things that we see or hear or do on the rivers. We can't be taking them home with us.
I understand, and you have to watch your own side of things as well. Deborah, I'm hearing an English accent, I think, from you.
Yes, yes.
Arthur, I'm not hearing an English accent from you.
Oh, born, bred Galway.
A proper, what is it, Ballinasloe?
Oh, yes.
Oh, proper, okay. Now, so how does a Ballinasloe boy meet a London lady?
I was very lucky.
Good answer, Arthur. Smooth. Keep going.
I moved here when I was 14 with my family, and I met Arthur outside the gates of the convent school.
Many
years ago.
I'm not letting you off that easily. Go on.
Well, he was dressed in black leather biker gear, and I'll never forget the first time I saw him. And it wasn't long before we married. I was 17, he was 19. That was 38 years ago, the day before yesterday. So, you know.
So you're together, you're married how long now?
38 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. The day before yesterday.
The day before yesterday. That's tremendous. Okay, so you're based in Ballinasloe, are you now, or you're in Galway City? Yeah.
We're based in Ballinasloe.
You're in Ballinasloe. I was talking to David Brophy. He's the conductor from the RT. Well, sorry, he used to be with the RT Concert Orchestra. He's now just an amazing gun for hire. And he does these beautiful things with charities, and whether it's carers or with the homeless.
And in the middle of our conversation, we got talking about how he had a pretty tough childhood in school. Bad time. And yet, goodness won out. He chose to be one of life's very good, kind people. And the reason I bring David up is because there's a certain symmetry with your own story, Deborah, particularly this morning, that you've spoken about before. And I'd like you to share, if it's not too intrusive with our listeners, as to what happened to you in 2011 and how that might have fueled where you are today.
In 2011, I was feeling very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. I was in quite a stressful job. I had gone to Australia the previous year and I'm adopted and I'd met my birth mother and it hadn't ended up as well as I'd hoped. And by 2011, I was so stressed and so strung out that I had a breakdown. And I went home, mm-hmm. and because I was living away from home working, and I just cocooned myself for months on end because I was just in such a raw state. And it wasn't long after this that Arthur, he's told me since, that he said to himself that if we got through it in one piece, this breakdown of mine, if we made it through to the other side, that he wanted to help people never to be in the same position as we were again.
And can I ask you, and forgive me for interrupting, but I do want to ask you, what does a breakdown look like or feel like?
For me, it was a long time coming. I was on a path. I was sliding into it for around 2.5 years.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And it took me a long, long time to get out of it. So, you know, I was nervous. I wasn't able to sleep. I was in constant pain, physically and mentally. And it was just a horrendous situation. I look back and I wonder how on earth I managed to keep getting up each morning and going to work because, you know, I would find myself crying in my office and, you know, trying to keep it all together, juggling so many different things and feeling as though I had no choice but to keep going, which, of course, isn't the case. But I couldn't see that.
Well, there you are. I think so many people feel that is the case and they keep going. But actually, they need to be told you have to stop. You have to mind yourself.
Yeah.
So how did you get to that critical point?
To figure out how to recover.
Yes, to kind of step. You described it as slipping down like a horrible landslide down a cliff. So how did you manage to stop that?
It was a couple of things. Arthur started the charity Galway East Life Support. There had been some suicides in Ballinasloe, and everyone was affected. Every single person we met was affected by them. So he approached a few different people in Ballinasloe, including the local superintendent, Jerry Roach. He's now chief super. And the two of them made such a formidable team. They put together the group. They put together a poster detailing 7 different charities and a breakdown of what they did, covering all kind of aspects, you know, covering kind of the loss of a small child, covering the loss of a close family member, covering, you know, issues, jigsaw for mental health for youth. And it was a huge success. And they just progressed from there. They did community talks. I wasn't bought in the beginning, to say the least. I was quite resentful. I was feeling quite precious about myself because I was feeling so bad that I couldn't really see why he was doing this. But little by little, he started getting me to write emails for him and do the odd letter for him and maybe design a poster. And as time went by, I found I was getting more and more invested in it. And then I was getting territorial and I was saying, no, I'll do that. Don't give that to somebody else. I'll do that task. And it wasn't long before I was bought into it completely.
You were getting better.
I was getting better. It was the best therapy I could have ever had.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Because that word you use, resentful, excuse me, is interesting because you obviously were all about you.
Yes.
Would that be fair to say? Not to be dodgy, but...
I couldn't think of anyone else, you know. Yeah. It was. I just felt so bad and I was trying so hard to recover. So it was a mixture of things that's got me to where I am today. Obviously, the charity work is a huge thing for me. Mm. I love every minute of it, but I'm very much a keyboard warrior. I do all of my work on the sofa in the evening with a laptop. And I've just found that I also had a really good therapist. Now, I'm not going to deny that. He's an amazing man for more and more.
Great.
So between the two, you know, it's worked wonders.
It's a collaborative effect of proper care for the mind and for the soul. So you're sounding good form, I have to say, which is great to hear and reassuring. Yeah, go on.
Oh, well, I was just going to say also that because of the work with Galway East Life Support, we would put on mental health safe talk and assist courses each year. And because the organisation was putting them on, I actually did them myself. And I progressed from there to do many more mental health training,
great,
including some professional training.
Great.
So by educating myself, I've learned so much about myself, and I've learned why I feel the way I feel and how to deal with it. So Arthur's a big advocate of local intervention, and I think the most local intervention you can have is actually to train yourself. You know, those courses aren't being done face-to-face, but there's many of them online that you can do.
That's the new reality, isn't it?
Absolutely. And some of them are really excellent.
And tell me this, Arthur, on the Clatter Watch project, if you want to call it that, where do you work out of in Galway in terms of a base?
Well, that's a point at the moment.
Go on.
We're looking for a place to that we can call home, because there's so many volunteers now, but we're working out of a container that was very generously given to us by Paul Carey Construction, and the area that it's in, it's at the back of Munro's Tavern, which they were very generous in allowing us to put it there.
When you say containers, it's like a space that you can work in.
It's like a railway container.
Right.
It's a lock-up container at the back of Munro's Tavern, right, and that's what we're working out of.
What would you like?
I would like a place that we could call home, where we could have a meeting.
Mm-hmm. An office of some sort.
Training.
Office, training, facilities, just somewhere, as I said, that we can call home.
Okay. We've been donated a couple of bicycles, and it would be amazing to have volunteers out on bikes. They'd be able to cover so much more ground.
Mm.
But we just don't have any room in the current base for that. We don't even have room for them to get changed properly.
Yeah, that's a pity. Now you could really do with that lift. So, are you fundraising or for this, or are you counting on the kindness of strangers, or how does that work?
Galway City is an amazing place, truly amazing, and the amount of support that we get, not alone from the public, but from the businesses, and we all know the extraordinary hard times that we're going through, and the businesses, the problems that they're having, they have never once let us down. Anything we wanted, any time we've spoken to anybody on the bridge, they have just been so, so generous. And, you know, like, there are just too many to mention, because I'd be afraid in case I'd leave out somebody.
No, that's okay. And in fact, one of the reasons we're talking today is because you weren't you nominated for a Safety and Emergency Award by the wonderful people at Volunteering Ireland?
Yes,
congratulations.
We were. Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Such a wonderful surprise.
Good for morale, eh?
Absolutely. Totally unexpected. We'd hoped that Clatter Watch would get a nomination, which it did, but totally didn't see the other one coming in for myself and Arthur.
Well, that's good news. And the Christine Buckley Volunteer of the Year Award, have you heard of that?
I've heard of it, yes.
Yeah,
I was reading about it the other day.
That's awarded to one particularly exceptional volunteer every year. And we spoke to Christine's son, Connor, not too long ago. A lovely family and lovely person Christine was too. Anyway, this great Volunteer of the Year Award is normally given to one person, but they've decided to make an exception this year. I don't know if you heard about this, but they're giving it to two exceptional people. And I'm talking to them right now. Congratulations.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Arthur and Deborah, they've decided. Yeah, you've just won. You have won the Christine Buckley Volunteer of the Year Award. If you see our dear friend John, should be coming in to you now. There.
Oh,
yeah,
oh,
and he's bringing
you
€1,000 euro for your charity. Congratulations. And a framed piece of Galway art and a plaque. Lads, bring in the applause. Congratulations, Arthur, Deborah, for all your hard work.
Thank you so
much. You're kind and you're thoughtful and you're altruistic and you're the true spirit of volunteerism in Ireland. It's a beautiful thing that you do, and Dunica from Volunteer Ireland is going to meet you there afterwards and tell you why you've won this. You don't need me to tell you, because you've just explained it. How are you feeling?
Somebody will pay for this.
It's John. Blame John. But here, just so you know, this was awarded for your commitment, your professionalism and your positive impact. This has been a year that needs all of those things. So on behalf of us, but particularly Volunteer Ireland, congratulations. You deserve it all.
Oh, Ryan, thank you. Thank you so much.
No, Ryan, thank you, guys.
Can I just one thing?
Yes,
Arthur.
I
would like to emphasise, it's not that I want the last word, I'm going to stop after this. We want to emphasise that Clatter Watch Patrol we're not a suicide prevention charity. We're out there to prevent the accidental deaths and the suicides on the river, because you know, there are a huge amount of accidental deaths as well, and them are the people that we will be looking out for.
As you say that, Roger Sweeney is the Deputy CEO of Water Safety Ireland, who's quickly to text in to say thanks to everybody at Claddagh Watch, all the volunteers for their efforts. An average of 10 people drown nationwide every month, and one third of those are suicides. So kind regards. You make a difference. We appreciate what you do. Arthur, Deborah, happy Christmas.
Thank you so much.
And congratulations. Thank you, Ryan. Nice to talk to you both.
Thank you.
I'll see you in Galway sometime.
I hope so. Thank you.
I hope so too. Take care.